I've been a cop for just over 6 years now, and I've seen some crazy stuff in that time. But only one call has been enough to give me nightmares, and it was this one. In November of 2023, it was just past midnight, and my partner and I were working a quiet shift when our radio suddenly cracked to life. Dispatch relayed a welfare check request. Someone had called in, worried about his former girlfriend. He got some troubling texts from her, things that were extremely out of character but enough to raise red flags, and my partner and I took the call. The address was a small apartment complex, one of those old brick buildings that's seen better days. We grabbed the ex's phone from dispatch and headed out. When we pulled up at around 12:45 a.m., the street was completely silent except for the hum of our cruiser's engine, and the apartment was on the second floor, Unit 2B. But there were no lights visible from the street, which kind of struck me as odd given the situation. If she was texting her ex, you'd think that she'd be awake and maybe have a lamp or the TV on or something, but there was nothing. We climbed the stairs and knocked on the door.
"Police, open the door, man. We're here to check on you."
Nothing. No footsteps, no muffled TV, just silence. I knocked again, harder this time, pounding with the side of my fist, and still nothing. Daniels, my partner, suggested that we call her. The ex-boyfriend had provided her number, so I dialed it from my department-issued cell. It rang once and twice and then picked up. I heard breathing on the other end. It was faint, but it was there before the line went dead. But here's the thing. We heard the phone ring from inside, faint but audible through the window to the left of the door, and there was no question. She was in there.
"Ma'am, this is the police,"
I shouted, leaning toward the window.
"We know you're inside. Open the door. We're doing a welfare check."
There was no response at first, but then I caught a slight sound. It was very slurred, garbled speech, like someone trying to talk through a mouthful of cotton, and it was enough to justify, in my mind, a forced entry.
"We're breaking the door down if you don't open up,"
I warned, giving her one last chance. We want to help, but we also don't want to overreact and potentially damage property or hurt somebody behind the door. But then seconds later, I hear a click as the deadbolt turned. The door didn't swing open. She'd unlocked it, but let it for us to open. I remember Daniels and I exchanged this look, and our hands were on our holsters, and then I pushed the door open with my boot. And what we saw stopped us completely cold. Standing there, swaying gently back and forth, was a young woman. She was stick thin and looked to be in her 20s, stark naked, dripping wet, and pale as a ghost. Her skin had that bluish tinge that you see in hypothermia cases, and her hands were a mess, and blood dripping from cuts on her palms and fingers. Her eyes were glassy, unfocused, and she was mumbling something incoherent. Then the next thing, the smell hit us. Metallic. Like old blood, but mixed with something stale and damp.
"Ma'am, are you all right?"
I asked, stepping forward, and she didn't respond. Just kept swaying, barely holding herself.
"Call a bus,"
I told Daniels. Bus being the slang for an ambulance. And he nodded and got on the radio while I tried to assess her. I asked her question after question, but got no answer. Just more slurring of words. And her condition seemed critical. Pale, cold, bleeding, and disoriented. I grabbed a blanket from the couch nearby and draped it over her shoulders, trying to keep her warm until EMS arrived. And she didn't resist, didn't even seem to notice. Once the girl was scared, the first thing we noticed when we started looking around the room was the candles. Flickering flames were dotted all over the place. The living room, the bedroom, even a couple in the bathroom, too. I flipped a light switch on, but I got nothing. I tried another, and it was dead. None of them worked, but there was no time to figure out if it was a power outage or a blown fuse, because we had to secure the scene and make sure that she was the only one here. My partner pulled out his flashlight, and I followed. The beams cut through the darkness and revealed a scene that still gives me chills thinking about it. Words, scrawled in what looked like blood. Her blood, I think, judging from her hands. and I remember seeing the words, seven-headed serpent in the bedroom, and then just, disobserves in the bathroom. And the handwriting was shaky and uneven, like she'd been trembling when she wrote it. And we moved to the bathroom following the trail of candles, and that's where we saw the tub. It was filled with water. Dark, murky brown water, like it had been stained with old blood or something else. And the surface was still, but you could tell that the girl had been sitting in it, likely for hours based on the ex's timeline when he last heard from her. The water was cold to the touch, and the blood had settled into a sort of thick, congealed layer toward the bottom. How she was even alive, I honestly couldn't tell you. The blood loss, hypothermia, she honestly should have been a goner. EMS arrived within 10 minutes, thank God. Paramedics rushed in, took one look at her, and got to work. They wrapped her in thermal blankets and started an IV and loaded her onto a stretcher, and she was still mumbling, incoherent as they wheeled her out. I remember they said possible overdose, severe blood loss, and hypothermia. And she's lucky that you got here when you did. With the girl en route to the hospital, Daniels and I finished our sweep of the area, and no one else was in the apartment, and there were no signs of a struggle or forced entry. Just the candles, the blood, and those goddamn words. We secured the scene, and then a detective was called in to take over. This wasn't just a welfare check anymore. It was a potential crime scene, or, at the very least, a mental health crisis that needed more than a patrol response. And back at the station, I wrote up my report, but all of those images stuck with me. The flickering candles, the tub of dark water, and the bloody words. I later Googled them, and this was what came up for the seven-headed serpent. The seven-headed serpent in Sumerian religion was one of the heroes slain by Ninurta, patron god of Lagash in ancient Iraq. Its body was hung on the shining crossbeam of Ninurta's chariot. It took me a little longer to figure out what disobserves might have meant, and I thought that it might have been a name. But a little later I found this about a place called Dis. In Dante Alighieri's The Divine Comedy, the city of Dis encompasses the 6th through the 9th circles of hell. Moated by the river Styx, the fortified city encloses the whole of lower or nether hell. And I've seen a lot on this job. Domestic disputes, overdoses, bar fights. But this was different. It was very unsettling. Like we walked into something bigger than just a bad breakup or a rough night. I don't know what drove her to that point, and I don't know if she'll pull through, but I do know this. If her ex hadn't called, if we hadn't gotten there when we did, I doubt that she would have made it. My daughter's a big fan of your YouTube channel, and after doing a bit of listening myself, I reckon that I've got a story that you might be interested in. My daughter's heard this story about 100 times by this point, but I reckon she'll get a kick out of hearing you retell it in your own inimitable style. It took ages to write, so give it a read and let me know what you think. I was born in October of 1959 at the Oxford Street Maternity Hospital in Liverpool, to a Jamaican mum and an English dad. I had quite a happy childhood. My dad was a docker, so he brought home a decent wage, and my mum worked 2 days a week as a seamstress. And so, all in all, we were quite well off, and I've got a lot of happy memories of being a kid. But then in 1969, less than a week after we all gathered round the telly to watch the Yanks put a man on the moon, my mom sat me down at the dinner table and told me Dad wasn't coming home. There had been an accident on the docks, he'd been hurt, and after they took him to hospital, he'd sadly gone to heaven to be with Nana and Granddad. And it wrecked us. Mom couldn't make the same wage my dad had, so we had to move out of the nice house we had and into a much smaller flat. She struggled with the grief and drank a lot to numb the pain, so she was either at work all day or at the Caribbean Center getting drunk until they kicked her out. And I don't blame her. She'd lost her soulmate, but it left me and my sister to fend for ourselves in a lot of ways. And don't get me wrong, she always made sure that there was food on the table, but the hard truth of it is that, probably from the age of about 12, I was brought up on the streets by the blokes that ran them. By the time my dad passed, the youth culture in Liverpool was becoming less and less about pints and ciggies, and more about pills and ganja. Not ecstasy pills, mind you, more like uppers and downers and all of that. But while the pints were legal, the pills and the ganja weren't, and there was a lot of money to be made trading them if you could stomach the lifestyle. And by the time I was 15, so around late 74, 75, a lot of the lads around Toxteth, or Liverpool 8 as we called it, had graduated to selling heroin and cocaine, not just ganja, since there was loads more money to be made in that, and the networks expanded massively. Some of my old mates from back then used to run bags for a few quid on the weekends, and over time, things got worse and worse. Just a few months before my 20th birthday, the Toxteth riots of 1981 had the south central portion of Liverpool in flames. The police took a pretty strong battering, too. They had to call in riot squads from other cities because they were so outnumbered by the rioters. And afterwards, parts of Toxteth were basically no-go areas for police, as next to lawless as it's possible to get in a so-called civilized society. Crime rose, employment fell, the drug scene exploded, and if you wanted to make something of yourself, you needed to join a gang, or firm, as we called them back then. And so that's what I did. By 1989, I was working with a crew that moved drugs all over England, Scotland, and Wales. The drug scene had gotten bigger and bigger as the years went by, with huge demand for the likes of MDMA tablets and crack cocaine. Then, thanks to Liverpool's docks, shipping in weed and pills from Amsterdam was basically as easy as ordering an Amazon package these days. Once you'd build up a relationship with someone over in the dam, you phoned them up, placed your order, then within a few days, your ship came in. My partner Jimmy and I used to take home 150 quid for every day that we were on the job, when back then that was megabucks, and we worked 6 days a week all year round except Christmas. It was boss money, but we had to work hard for it. Jimmy and I worked for a crew ran by a bloke named Jabbo, and by 89, we'd been working together for about 18 months. We didn't really do gang names or anything like that, not like the Crips or the Bloods over in America. Back then, everyone knew who worked with who, so it was all your firm and my firm, and not the Bloody Sharks and the Jets like some Camp Broadway musical. There weren't any proper job descriptions either, not like the mafia. We didn't have enforcers or capos or consignieres or nothing like that. You just had your boys and your boss. Simple. So when it comes to describing what we did all day, Jimmy and I did a bit of everything. We moved gear, drugs, collected debts, mostly amicably, and did any small jobs that needed doing, be it giving people lifts or dropping off cooking supplies. But we didn't have any kind of official title. We were just George and Jimmy. We didn't need anyone else because our reputations preceded us. Actually, I suppose you could have assigned us each a sort of title or role, something that really summed up what we did, because when it came to collecting cash from people that owed it, I played the good cop, and Jimmy played the bad cop. Jimmy was the cousin of the fella we worked for, Jabbo, and he was a complete and utter psychopath. Half the reason I'd been selected to work with him was as a kind of governor, someone who'd stop him from going over the edge whenever he got into one of his moods. The main reason our debt collection always went smoothly is 'cause Jimmy was there, and all I'd have to say is, "Look, mate, it's him or me. So we're going to make the bank, or you going with him?" They'd nearly always pay up, and the one or two times they didn't, Jimmy got to cement our reputation even further, and he loved it too. And I mean it when I say he was a psycho. These days, they'll call you a psycho if you go for a jog before work in the mornings. Jimmy, on the other hand, liked jogging on people's faces. He genuinely enjoyed violence, so I never had to partake of any myself. But even with me having seen my fair share of blood growing up, the things Jimmy did were the stuff of nightmares. But the violence was only directed towards people who stole, people who owed money, or people who misbehaved in other more minor ways. Conflict with other firms just didn't really happen because everyone stuck to their own turf and there were enough customers to go around. But that all changed toward the end of the 80s, when the surge in demand for the big money makers like heroin and crack meant that there was money flowing round like never before. And I won't bore you with the exact ins and outs of it, or this'll end up being a novel, but in 1989, there was a major change of leadership in one of the neighboring firms. This new boss was very ambitious, too, and, in so many words, thought the firm should let the market decide who buys from who rather than set territories. He starts sending his dealers onto Jabo Streets, Jabo being our boss, remember, to poach his customers, and then when Jabo finds out, he sends me and Jimmy out looking for the dealers to give them a firm but polite talking to. But they were not open to any sort of discussion or criticism, and when they turned to threats and insults, Jimmy flipped his lid and battered the pair of them. He didn't just batter them either. He pulled the one lad off of his bike and then used his own front tire to turn his face into a mess of blood and black smudges. And that was one of the few times I felt very little sympathy for the person on the receiving end of Jimmy's temper. We didn't think, though, that that had started a war. The new boss of the neighboring firm wouldn't take kindly to having his dealer beaten, but honestly, there was a bit of a mutual understanding when it came to younger lads getting lippy with their elders. We thought the new boss would approach Jabo maybe with an apology, but definitely a demand for money to get his boy's teeth fixed, because good God, did he need it. Instead, the neighboring firm ran up to Jabo's living room window one night and then blasted the glass in with a shotgun. Jabo's two kids were in there at the time, watching telly. But because they were sitting on the floor in front of it, the shotgun pellets missed them, and they only got a few cuts and splinters after being showered in glass. That didn't matter at all, though, because Jabo and Jimmy were livid. We went out looking for anyone even remotely associated with the now enemy firm, but we couldn't find a soul. It was like they'd all vanished into thin air. We then got word that, basically, the lad that got his face smashed with his own bike tire had gone completely rogue and was on the hunt for Jimmy's family in particular, which obviously meant Jabo's family too. We had to find Tireface, as I'll call him from now on, before he found any of us, and unfortunately, he found Jabo's sister first. He didn't kill her, thank God, but she ended up in hospital in a serious condition, and if you thought Jabo and Jimmy were angry before, that was nothing on what they were like after their sister/cousin was shot. They were bloodthirsty. That's the best way I can describe it. But Tireface had been clever and had moved all of his family somewhere secret to keep them safe while the war was on. He was pretty decent at hiding himself, too. We were looking high and low, offering all kinds of money for sightings of him, but he was like a ghost. But that couldn't last forever. He was always going to slip up eventually, and when he did, we were going to make him pay for it. Jimmy and I waited, and we waited, and then we waited some more, running business at basically half capacity while we hunted for Tireface. Then at about noon one day, I got a call from Jimmy saying that I had to be ready to go by 2 p.m. sharp. And he sounded frantic, and this might sound a bit mad, but he sounded frighteningly happy, too. So I knew what was going on, or had a decent enough idea. Someone had either spotted Tireface someplace, or he was expected somewhere, and we were going to be there when he arrived. Jimmy was mental, but he wasn't stupid. He wasn't going to talk about what we were going to do, especially not in his car, which for those of you that don't know, is an ideal place for the police to put a listening device since so much chat goes on during car journeys. We were all right talking football, or just about this and that, but since this car journey was strictly business, we stayed quiet for almost the entire drive. It was a long one, too, and I realized that we were heading out of Liverpool quite quickly. We drove until we were on the outskirts of Manchester, and then Jimmy handed me a road map of the area and then told me to find an address that he had written on a piece of paper. I remember thinking, bloody hell, this lad's run off to Manchester and Jabo still had him tracked down. But that's what it was like working for people with those kinds of connections. Sometimes it was slapstick, other times it was like being in a spy film. But you learn not to ask too many questions. People who keep their mouths shut don't just learn a lot, they live a long time as well. But anyway, We find the address, then Jimmy tells me to get behind the wheel before he gets out and starts walking up the pathway of this nice little cottage-looking place that looked like it was worth a few quid. He walked up to the front door, knocked on it, then pulled a balaclava over his face and barged his way inside when some poor old dear opened up. Maybe a minute later, he reappeared again, but he didn't have Tire Face with him. Under his arm, being carried like a rolled-up carpet, was a little girl, no more than about 5 or 6 years old. He basically throws this poor girl in the back seat, climbs in next to her, and then screams at me to drive. After that, it was over to some old abandoned farm buildings near St. Helens, but not before we'd stopped somewhere to give Jabbo a call to let him know that we had a hostage. I thought the idea of taking a hostage was to get Tireface to come out of hiding, and I think maybe at first that was actually the plan. But then at one point, Jimmy drove off to get some food, and when he came back, he was in a terrible state. Jimmy's cousin, slash Jabbo's sister, who had been shot in the back, had contracted the superbug MRSA while in the hospital. She'd been fighting with it for about a week, but then that same afternoon we kidnapped Tireface's kid, she went into cardiac arrest and passed away. Jabbo and Jimmy were devastated, so in response, Jabbo gave Jimmy the order to kill Tireface's daughter. But he wasn't just going to kill her. He was going to cut her head off so Jabbo could lash it into Tireface's lap whenever he finally got his hands on him. We had this girl's hands and legs tied, and she'd actually calmed down a bit because we'd promised to feed her before taking her back to Mummy and Daddy. But when Jimmy walked back into the old cow shed, instead of a plastic bag with 3 chippy dinners in it, he had nothing but a rusty-looking hacksaw in his hand. He looked ill, sweaty, shaky, eyes wide and bulging, and I knew what he had been told to do without having to ask him, and all I could think to ask was, "Jimmy, what are you doing?" He didn't even look at me, let alone say anything. He just kept on taking these slow, careful steps towards the little girl, and I could see him trying to summon the will to do as he'd been told. I'd been carrying a gun with me ever since the war started, and that day was no exception, so when I pulled it out, Jimmy thought it was me silently saying, "Let's put her out of her misery first so she doesn't suffer too much." But that wasn't what was about to happen. That was never what was about to happen. And the look on his face when I pointed the gun at him is something I'll never forget. He couldn't believe what he was seeing. He couldn't believe I'd even dare to do something like that. It was his turn to understatedly ask, "What are you doing, George?" But as stunned as he looked in that moment, it was nothing on how he looked after what I said next. I told him to put the saw down and step away from the girl. And that's when Jimmy stated out loud that Jabbo had told him to kill her because his cousin, Jabbo's sister, had died that same afternoon. The girl had to die, blood for blood. I told him that wasn't going to happen and repeated my order to put it down. He took a step toward me, I took one back, and then I told him to put that down and to get on the floor because I was an undercover police officer for Maryside Police, and he was under arrest for kidnap and conspiracy to murder. And for a second, Jimmy looked like he was about to pass out. His mouth flopped open and closed like a caught fish on a riverbank, and his arm, which had previously been pointing that hacksaw at me, slowly dropped to his side. He asked me if I was joking. I told him no, that I wasn't messing around and that his only chance to avoid arrest was to get back in the car and F off back to Liverpool. I knew I wasn't physically capable of arresting him, but Jimmy wasn't about to turn down his get-out-of-jail-free card, not while I had a gun pointed at him. After he left, I ran over open fields hand in hand with that little girl until we found a homeowner who had let me use their phone. Now I suppose here's the part where I address the "so that's what I did" line in reference to joining a gang. I did join a gang, a massive one in fact, and we called ourselves the Maryside Police Force. I started to think about joining after the riots because I saw all kinds of people who weren't part of the Toxteth community flooding that area to take advantage. Don't get me wrong. The police were very heavy-handed with the youth at the time, so I can't forgive the anger. But in the aftermath, you had one of the biggest and scummiest drug dealers in the country making himself out to be a savior of the community, all while he was poisoning it with heroin. And it made me sick. And I knew my dear old dad would have been ashamed to see Toxteth take such a dive. So instead of just leaving, like a lot of people did, I decided to stick around to help fix a two-tier problem that I thought was happening. Problems in the community, and problems in the force that policed it. I'd like to think that I put a dent in both during my long career in the police service, but after the incident with Jimmy and the little girl, those dents weren't going to be in Liverpool, that's for sure. I transferred to London after almost everyone in Jabbo's crew, as well as Tireface, was sent down for crimes of varying severity, and spent the rest of my career working my way up the ladder of the Met's undercover department. I helped oversee some incredible investigations in that time, some more successful than others, but I never forgot the day that I betrayed Jimmy and saved that little girl's life as a result. And I'll never forget because I actually kept a little memento of that incident, and it came in the form of the mitigation statement read out by Tireface's solicitor following his conviction for attempted murder. Through his lawyer, Tireface mostly said that he was sorry for everything he'd done, but also issued a personal thank you to the undercover police officer who saved his daughter's life. He didn't know who that undercover officer was, and maybe he's since figured it out, who knows. But knowing he appreciated it so much that he'd thank a policeman before being sent to prison, it honestly meant the world to me, and it still does, even all these years later. And I visit Liverpool every so often. Sometimes I'll go and see old colleagues, and other times I'll stop by Anfield to watch Liverpool play. I miss the place. It'll always be my home. But it was also worth giving up if it meant giving an innocent little girl a chance to live. It was one of those days where the sky was as clear as you really could have hoped for, not a cloud in sight. My partner and I were on a routine patrol just cruising through the neighborhood when it happened, and it happened out of nowhere. Some guy decides that he's going to be the end of me. So I was walking up to this character, just doing my job, when, like a bolt from the blue, he pulls out a 9mm from his jacket. Time slows down, in my mind, right? You see the gun, you see the barrel, and you know what comes next. He points it at me, his eyes are wide, wild with some kind of fear or anger, I really couldn't tell. And then he pulls the trigger. But here's the thing. He did everything wrong. Maybe he was too scared or too angry or just plain didn't know how to handle a gun. The hammer fell, but the gun didn't fire. The chamber must have been empty or the safety was on or who knows what. I didn't stick around to find out. And in that split second, I saw my life flash before my eyes, but then I was moving. Adrenaline took over, and I lunged for him. He was so shocked that his gun didn't work, he just stood there, his grip loosening. The pistol hit the ground, and he starts screaming, "Don't shoot me, please don't shoot me," like he hadn't even done anything at all to me. And I'll admit, I was scared out of my mind. My heart was pounding so bad that I thought it was going to burst out of my chest. By the time we got back to the station, I was still wired. My body was buzzing with the aftermath of that rush. I tried to sit down, tried to write up the arrest report, but my right leg would not cooperate. It was like I had a pogo stick for a limb, bouncing up and down with the leftover adrenaline. My hands were shaking too. When another officer brought me a glass of water, thinking it'd calm me down, I ended up spilling half of it all over my desk. That moment, that near miss with death, it stuck with me. The sheer enormity of the fact that I was still breathing because of his stupidity was something that I couldn't shake off. It wasn't just luck. It was a reminder of how thin the line is between life and death when you're in this line of work. As I wrote the report, detailing every moment of the encounter, I kept running through what could have been. If he had known how to actually use that gun, if he had prepared it properly, I wouldn't be here. But he didn't, and I was, and that's not something you forget. It's a lesson in humility and the randomness of fate. The guy, he was charged with attempted murder, among other things. But for me, the real takeaway was the haunting realization of how close I came to not making it home. And every day now, I check my gear more thoroughly, and I treat every encounter with a bit more caution. Because you never know when the clear blue sky might just turn dark. I found this police report from the 90s at the National Archives in Seattle. You can basically make an appointment and then spend a few hours reading old police reports and stuff, and most are pretty standard and there's not much of interest about them. But occasionally, you find one like this. Incident at 601 Franklin Avenue. Date, 10/11/93. Time, 13:22. Reporting officer, Deputy Andrew A. Wenzel, 498. Incident description. I received a dispatch call at approximately 1:22 p.m. regarding a male subject at 1433 Murray Drive, who was reportedly behaving erratically. The caller described the man as appearing to suffer from hallucinations and was audibly claiming that his skin was on fire. I was expecting the man to be in a state of intoxication or that perhaps he was suffering some kind of mental breakdown, but upon my arrival at the scene, I was met with a sight that I can only describe as the most disturbing of my entire career. The man, identified later as Paul Weldon, was lying on the front lawn, clearly deceased, with his body severely charred and burned. I immediately secured the area and called for medical and fire department personnel, although it was clear that there was no saving the individual. Witnesses on the scene, including Sharon McManus, provided a consistent account of what had transpired. They stated that, after running up and down the street, screaming about his skin being on fire, the man had suddenly burst into flames. He then collapsed to the ground and continued to burn intensely. They also described how the flames seemed to suddenly and inexplicably extinguish themselves, leaving the man's body severely burnt, yet without any apparent external source of ignition. What was particularly baffling and unsettling to all those who attended the scene was the condition of the surrounding area. There were no signs of scorch marks or any indication of fire spread on the grass or nearby objects. The lawn around the deceased appeared untouched by fire, which defied any logical explanation or previous experience I have had with fire-related incidents. The fire department also confirmed no accelerants were present and that the lack of fire damage to the area surrounding the body was highly unusual. This case remains open, with investigations into possible spontaneous human combustion or other as yet unexplained phenomena. The medical examiner has taken custody of the body for further examination and statements from all witnesses are being processed. This incident has left an indelible mark on my career, not just for the visual horror, but for how difficult I find rationalizing it. It's something that I doubt I will ever fully understand or ever fully forget. Deputy Andrew Arthur Wenzel, 498 Carson County Sheriff's Office, Texas. This email comes from a proton.me email arriving in the Let's Read submissions inbox. It appears to be from an anonymous source in the St. Louis Police Department. It reads as follows. Dear Sir, it has come to my attention that your rather sizable audience is in need of a terrifying but ultimately true story, and while not particularly long or meandering, I think this is one they need to hear. One of my favorite quotes is from one of our founding fathers, James Madison, when he said, "The truth is that all men having power ought to be mistrusted." I first heard it way back at the very beginning of my career, and over my 35 years as a serving police officer, those words were never far from my mind. Since we're charged with upholding the law, we have to hold ourselves to a higher standard than our civilian counterparts, meaning sometimes we have to direct that sense of mistrust towards our very own selves. Because sometimes, it's not so much the power of holding a badge and a gun that corrupts a man. We have all kinds of oversight and regulatory bodies to ensure that when an officer does step over that moral red line, he's suitably punished for it. And I'm sorry, but I will get poetic here. For what is truly corrosive to an officer's soul is an overexposure to the very poison he seeks to combat. And that is perhaps the most insidious trait in all of law enforcement. When a good cop, over the course of many months and years, becomes a bad cop. One morning, in September of 2023, I received a report that two of my officers had been called to a domestic dispute the previous evening, in which a 29-year-old man named Urayoan Rodriguez Rivera had suffered an unfortunate accident involving a firearm he owned. At around 6:30, when my officers arrived at the scene, they found Mr. Rodriguez Rivera lying at the base of a tree, struggling to breathe and suffering severe blood loss from wounds to his face and neck. He was in a critical condition and required urgent medical assistance, but instead of administering first aid or requesting the presence of emergency services, my officers chose to neglect and belittle Mr. Rodriguez Rivera in the final few moments of his life. An officer, Warren, is heard to comment, "We better take this mother effer in." To which an officer, Frazier, replies, "We aren't taking anything. I get off in 30 minutes. Let's cruise around and come back." Then, after walking away from the scene while laughing to one another, officers Warren and Frazier get back into their car and drive away from an active crime scene. They return to the scene at around 10 minutes later, just moments before a third police officer arrives on scene. At this point, I had to switch over to watching the body camera footage from this third officer, and what I saw shocked me to my core. Frazier and Warren began to pretend as if it's their first time at the scene, and began going through the motions of searching for the wounded Mr. Rodriguez Rivera, even though they knew exactly where he was. When the third officer spotted Mr. Rodriguez Rivera, he immediately notified dispatch and made a priority request that EMS come to the scene for a person still breathing with a gunshot wound to the head. Other officers also arrive shortly after and tape off the scene. One checks Rodriguez Rivera for a pulse, which he describes as super weak. That officer then searches the area for a firearm as another tries to render first aid. Just minutes later, the third officer's body camera shows Warren and Frazier walking to their police cruiser, then leaving the scene for a second time once additional officers had arrived. The third officer, who I believe exemplifies the true spirit of law enforcement in this fair city, tells a fourth, "You know what's effed up? Warren and Frazier just left." The same officer later says he's going to out the F out of Frazier and Warren for abandoning the scene because, he said, "You can't just leave." Emergency medical services arrived at the scene at 6:53 p.m., at which point Mr. Rodriguez Rivera was transported to the hospital, and that was around 27 minutes after Warren and Frazier first arrived at the scene, 27 minutes too late. Tragically, Mr. Rodriguez Rivera later passed away as a result of a single gunshot wound to the head, with the emergency surgeon who worked on him saying that, had he arrived a little earlier, they might well have been able to save his life. I will never forget the feeling which came over me when I watched the body-worn camera footage of the incident. I didn't know whether I was going to puke or smash my computer, and I think I must have watched it maybe 4 or 5 times before I could allow myself to believe what I was seeing and hearing. I couldn't grasp it at first. The officers in question weren't bad guys, or at least they didn't seem to be, and their disciplinary records didn't speak to that either. But I also observed that their psych profiles were long out of date, meaning it might have been possible to identify the problem before it resulted in such a grotesque dereliction of duty. Once the news hit the airwaves that the two officers had been suspended prior to an investigation, the press reached out to Mr. Rodriguez Rivera's mother, who lived in Puerto Rico. As a father, that was the part that really got to me. The part where a mother had to learn that not only had her son's death potentially been avoidable, but the very people charged with his protection had abandoned him when he needed them most. She claimed the officers lacked humanity, and that she hoped the full weight of the law fell on them. The media also reached out to our former chief, who made a very candid but deeply controversial statement. He said the officers' behavior was disgusting, that they'd be fired, and there was probably going to be a multi-million-dollar lawsuit. But from where he was standing, he couldn't see any criminal charges being filed against either officer. Both officers have since been fired by the St. Louis Metropolitan Police, with each of their police licenses being terminated. And in the state of Missouri, those licenses cannot be reinstated by law, so they will never again be allowed to act in a law enforcement capacity here in our fair state. But what truly concerns me isn't so much the fact that this happened, it's the potential for it to happen again. We, as those who volunteer to enforce the law, are faced with one of the most difficult jobs in the entire country. But while we have deep pockets for increasing surveillance and militarization, the resources we put aside to fight our mental battles are sorely lacking. I do not believe Warren or Frazier joined the St. Louis police force in order to neglect their duties and belittle a dying man. I believe that they were two once decent officers who, through a lack of mental hygiene and department support, made a terrible and regrettable mistake. And rightly so, it is a mistake that they have been punished for, and it remains to be seen if any further action will be taken against the two former officers. But when I say that this incident was avoidable, the avoidance lies in ensuring our protectors get the protection they need, not just from the violent criminals that seek to exploit and violate, but from the lesser angels of their own beings. Unfortunately, due to the departmental policy, I am unable to attach a name to my story without facing serious disciplinary consequences, hence why I'm sending this anonymously. Yet in good conscience, I can no longer remain silent. We should never forget about James Madison's words, nor should we ever grow tired of scrutinizing those who wield the whip over us. But in the same way we value the mental health of combat veterans, we need to do more to help those who help us. And for the time being, my task is to ensure such a failure does not occur again. We must rebuild trust and honor the memory of Mr. Rodriguez Rivera by ensuring our officers act with dignity and urgency required in such moments of crisis. And we do that with Kevlar for the mind. In the early hours of March 15th, 2024, the skies over New Mexico were still an inky black as State Police Officer Justin Hare drove down a dark stretch of the I-40. Except for a few passing vehicles, the highway was quiet, with the approaching dawn signaling that Hare's shift was coming to an end. But then at around 4:45 a.m., a call came through from his unit's dispatch requesting his help. According to the dispatcher, a motorist with a flat tire was signaling for assistance. Justin said he'd make his way to the driver's location, then set off in the direction of Tucumcari. As Justin arrived at the scene, he observed a white BMW sitting forlornly on the shoulder of the road. Its driver stood nearby as Justin pulled in behind the vehicle, then motioned for the driver to approach his cruiser. As the BMW's driver approached Justin's passenger window, the conversation started innocently enough. They discussed the flat tire, the early hour, and the lack of nearby services. Justin, keen to help a citizen in need, offered Smith a ride to the nearest town, where he could find the assistance he required. The driver smiled, thanked him for the offer, then before Justin realized what was happening, the BMW driver produced a 9mm pistol, and then put a bullet through the unsuspecting officer's neck. As Justin struggled to both stem the bleeding and unholster his weapon, the driver of the white BMW walked around to his driver's side window and then shot him twice more. He then shoved the dying officer over into the passenger seat, took command of the patrol car, and then began driving down the I-40 with a mortally wounded Justin gasping for air next to him. Upon reaching a frontage road, the driver stopped the cruiser. He then dragged Justin's incapacitated body from the passenger seat and then left him to die on a cold, dusty stretch of highway near Tucumcari, a name derived from the Comanche word which means ambush. The patrol car was later found crashed in Guadalupe County, and it wasn't long before the driver of the flat-tired BMW was identified as Jeremy Alexander Smith. Smith was already wanted in connection with the murder of Phonesia Mochado IV, the owner of the stolen BMW he was driving in South Carolina's Marion County. The manhunt began immediately, as a frantic search for Jeremy Smith gripped the entire southwestern United States. His criminal record painted a picture of a man who had been on a collision course with justice for years, a man who had left a trail of devastation wherever he went. But the shock and horror his actions resulted in were nothing compared to the grief and heartache the local community felt at losing one of its brightest and most selfless members in such a brutal and senseless fashion. Hours turned to days as the manhunt continued, with local law enforcement agencies remaining on high alert. But in the end, it was an era of unbridled stupidity which brought the hammer down on the fugitive Smith. After stopping at a gas station in Albuquerque, Smith was foolish enough to hand over his actual identification card to the attendant. The clerk recognized him in an instant, but kept her cool and completed the transaction. After that, it was simply a case of tracking the stolen car that he was driving, and then closing in to make an arrest. But Smith wasn't about to give up that easily. At exactly 7:49 a.m., two deputies of the Bernalillo County Sheriff found themselves sitting in their vehicle outside the address Smith was believed to be sheltering at. Smith apparently spotted the Bernalillo deputy's vehicle because seconds later, their cruiser's radio burst into life with cries of, he's running westbound. The cruiser zooms down a quiet suburban street, the sky a haze of grays and blues as the time ticks over to 7:51. Suddenly, the deputy in the passenger seat asks his partner to halt their cruiser, and as they step out, they are faced with a copper-brown two-story home complete with a white garage door. Smith had already taken the lives of both a police officer and a paramedic, but the two deputies remain unfaltering in their pursuit. They scan the two narrow passageways either side of the home before one quietly declares, "I can hear him." With pistols drawn, the two deputies begin their advance, the driver taking the left side of the house, the passenger taking the right. Within seconds, the deputy on the right-hand side of the house spots Smith. "Hey, get over here," he calls over to his partner. "I got contact. He's behind 3135. Suddenly, a black-clad Smith runs into view before swiftly darting through a small opening in the wall behind the home. "Stop running," the deputy cries, as both he and his partner give chase. The deputy rushes down the passageway, but is forced to slowly round a corner for fear of being ambushed. When the home's backyard proves uninhabited, the deputy grabs his radio and declares he's hopping fences. The deputy peers over a chest-high wall, then attempts to scale it, but as he reaches the top, he hears screaming coming from a neighboring house. "This way," the deputy cries, as he rushed back out into the street their cruiser is parked on. "He's this way, Sarge." As the deputy runs, the distant sound of sirens can be heard, and then suddenly, following a cry of "Stop, police," the sharp report of gunfire can be heard. "Shots fired," the deputy cries into his radio, his pace quickening as he rushes to assist his fellow deputies. Four shots are fired, a second long delay between each mechanical bark. "Where's he at?" the deputy cries. Then, when his question receives no response, he realizes he might have just heard the sound of a third person losing their life to Smith. Without hesitation, the deputy rushes down another narrow passageway. When he sees his sergeant, alive and unharmed, the relief in his voice is palpable. "Sarge," he yells, "where's he at?" Both men climb a dividing wall between the yards of two homes, balancing themselves precariously in the hopes of spotting their fugitive suspect. Civilians begin emerging from their homes, alarmed at the sound of gunfire. The two deputies tensely order the innocent back into their homes. A minute passes, both officers climb over another adjoining wall. Then, In a brief but surreal moment of stark contrast, the two deputies, whose very lives are under threat, run past a bright pink children's playhouse. Yet just as they do, the sound of a woman yelling in a neighboring yard demands their attention. "He's right here," one of the deputies shouts, as he spots the cop killer Jeremy Smith. His voice burns with fear and anger. "Stop," he yells. "Stop moving." But Smith pays no heed. He turns, then begins running away from the furious deputy who opens fire on the fleeing killer. In the chaos, at least one of his bullets appears to have struck Smith, as following a swift pursuit, he is found lying among the dirt and gravel of an unfinished pathway, having collapsed after attempting to scale a wall. "You ain't moving," the deputy roars. "Now roll over, roll over." Smith appears to cry out in pain before claiming, "Who ain't got nothing on me?" Yet an instant later, a civilian appears to yell from his window off camera, "I got a gun right here, he just threw it over." As Smith is set upon by the two deputies, he once again cries out in pain. He begs them for mercy, claiming his arm is in an unbearable amount of pain. One of the deputies, aware that Smith has already murdered a police officer who tried helping him, tells Smith to shut up. Smith then claims, "I can't breathe," and then proceeds to take a deep breath before crying out in pain again. From one of Smith's pockets, the deputy retrieves a green-colored packet of what appears to be cigarettes, then asks his name. Smith refuses to answer the question and simply replies, "I ain't got nothing." But after the deputy retrieves his wallet, his identification is confirmed. "Jeremy Alexander Smith," it reads. The deputies roll Smith over and sit him up. Blood trickles from a wound to his mouth, while a bullet wound to his left arm gives the dark fabric of his hoodie a glossy, gory sheen. "Please, please, please," Smith begs the officers, desperate for the kind of mercy he himself refused to bestow on both paramedic Phoenicia Machado IV and police officer Justin Hare, two people who dedicated their lives to helping others. The legal aftermath was swift and decisive, facing federal charges including carjacking resulting in death and discharging a firearm during a crime of violence. Smith was eventually charged with several counts. The weight of the evidence, including dash cam and body cam footage, left little room for doubt. In January of 2025, he pled guilty, accepting a sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. The courtroom was filled with law enforcement officers, there to honor Justin Hare, a man who had uttered his last words offering help to the man who would take his life. His family, particularly his parents, Jim and Terry Hare, spoke of the void left in their lives, of the grandchildren who would grow up without their father, and of the community that had lost a true protector. May he, and all other officers who make the ultimate sacrifice while heeding the call of duty, rest in deep and everlasting peace. Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday and Thursday at 9 p.m. EST, and there are super fun live streams on Sundays and Wednesday nights. If you got a story, be sure to submit them over at my email at letsreadsubmissions@gmail.com, and maybe even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations and bonus content over on Patreon, or click that big join button to hear about the extra perks for members of the channel. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all of these stories in big compilations located anywhere you listen to podcasts. All links in the description below. Thanks so much, friends. And remember to wash y'all's cracks.